How do we approach a client's shame without re-triggering painful memories? Often with shame, we're navigating around some pretty old wounds, and this can be hard, especially when those memories run deep. Here, Dr. Zindel Siegel and Dr. Elisha Goldstein offer two ways to work with shame by identifying the important part that gives it power.
So my understanding of shame is that there is a attribute of the self that a patient is frightened of revealing and experiencing, and that the capacity to experience that in a public way is something that is to be avoided at all costs. So part of that experience may not even be fully in awareness of the individual, but instead what the enactments are that reveal the possibility of shame have to do with preventing, escaping, and wanting to avoid a kind of catastrophic outcome. The patient that I'm thinking about is someone who I've been working with who is an accountant in a very high-flying firm, has a senior position, and is continually worried about being exposed for some kind of error or auditing mistake that might bring him into disrepute in the company. And his performance has never really had any markers of that sort of negligence, but very, very worried about it. The history, and there is relevance here, because shame is often something that can be experienced during early adulthood and then compounded as adults draw from that experience to understand current situations where exposure might be possible. So this is a person who was somewhat overweight, was teased at camp, was sort of singled out within a family that was very athletic as sort of falling short. And so some of those experiences of personal inadequacy and difficulty being seen in a way within the family and publicly are some of the same affects that come up in regard to some of the experiences in professional work sphere. So as a therapist, I think it's very important to be able to recognize that these are difficult affects for the patient to tolerate. And so even though you may be sitting there with a clinical formulation of, you know, there's this experience in young adulthood that may have been carried forward, the person is still in a sense schematizing their situation from that point of view, that insight is something that can potentially drive your own choice of interventions. But I haven't found that it's entirely helpful to present that to the client as a way of encouraging them to expose themselves to this inner distress, this inner difficulty. What I found is that it's very important to, first of all, step back and just name the difficulty. It's difficult for you to talk about these things, or it's difficult for you to allow yourself to feel the possibility of being seen in this way, or are you aware that when you speak about this, it's not an easy topic for you to address? So that there's a kind of safety built around the concept of can we develop a collaborative way of delving a little bit more deeply into this, but in a titrated, graduated manner. And so, for example, what we did was talk a little bit about and almost validate some of the catastrophizing that the person might engage in terms of, you know, having to be hyper careful and hypervigilant over making mistakes and being exposed in the firm. First of all, taking it to the place in the mind where the client might see it going, like, okay, so then what would happen if, you know, you did make a mistake? Where would that go? And then getting to some place usually which involves public exposure and an unmasking of some kind, which would be, you know, unbelievably difficult, never recover from, and reinforce the view that often was developed at a younger age where the person was told that they're not good enough or they're inferior to other people. And then those are some of the affects that eventually one wants to encourage the client to start to connect with. So it's a process It's not an insight specific antidote where if you can just point out, oh, here's the connection to what happened to you when you were younger. I mean, those might be things rolling around in the therapist's mind, as these are important connections to try to convey. But how you actually do that with a patient who is working with shame has to be very delicate, because I think the threat of recognition of these affects and the reinstantiation of that view of self is really tough unless people are able to tolerate their own distress for periods of time. And I think that that's a lot of the measure of therapeutic work that needs to get done in dealing with shame.
Here's a client who, in his mid-60s, professional executive, and grew up in a family from a different country. And in his family, one of the ways that they imbued shame within him was it was a very controlling family. And so you can also experience shame from a very controlling family, because the controlling family, the parents say, this is how it is. Your opinion really doesn't matter. The thing that you're doing here might we see as silly. It's not perfect. It needs to be feel perfect to the outside world. So for him, he loved like cartoons and particular characters, and he would even put posters up on his wall, you know, around these cartoons. But in his family, what was really important was like schoolwork and getting everything done just right. And anytime that he would start to play, his mom would come and just kind of reprimand him, telling him that that was not okay for him to be doing. That's just silly stuff. You know, and so we can see something as simple as this really imbuing a sense of shame. Fast forward into his life. And so he always felt like he was walking around eggshells as a kid, really, as this kind of controlling mom in his mind. And so fast forward many years later, lover of art, and he loves it so much that he struggles with anxiety and depression. This great sense of shame. Something's wrong with him. Fundamentally, that's the way he feels. And basically, he had a whole arsenal, really bookshelf, giant bookshelf of art books. Never opened one of them. Because in some ways, he felt like that he wasn't worth taking that time to kind of do that. And so we kind of recognize the shame that lives in him, where it came from. And that sense that something was wrong with him, something was defective. And so we started kind of working. So some of my angles that I work with, okay, so there's like some informal mindfulness in some way. But I like to kind of angle in towards play sometimes. If his issue was around play, play can be a great mediator to a stress response. It can really open us up. It helps us. There's a lot of neuroscience around it as far as like learning, helping us kind of learn and take in experiences more. So with him, I had him bring books into the session, and we looked through the books within him. Now, his stress response initially kind of came up. He noticed similar things again to when you experience shame. He noticed kind of sweaty palms. He noticed increased heart rate. And so what we did was we worked through some breathing practices, and these weren't necessarily mindfulness practices. They were more about kind of releasing, relaxing practices, which are good practices, and this is for another webinar perhaps. Around what are some good fundamental practices that aren't talked about very much when it comes to mindfulness. So we worked through that, and he kind of settled in. And then slowly he was able to do that, so much so that we took it a next step, and he went to Santa Fe, and or Taos, New Mexico, sorry. And then he started going after the galleries there. And as he did that, he noticed more stress response starting to come up. And so much so that he thought he was going to be sick and need to take a plane ride home. What that was, which was fascinating, we had talked about that this might happen, you know, as he did that was this sense of foreboding joy. This idea that don't allow yourself to feel too good because something terrible might happen, you know, around the corner. And he started to realize that, again, working with himself calming, getting a sense of confidence, sense of self-control, earning that security back, and inevitably having a beautiful experience lingering in the joy as it came. So there it is, working with shame, turning towards what's difficult can oftentimes bring in the light and bring in a sense of inner strength around self-control, earn security, self-compassion. All of these things are fantastic strengths that can be gained in working with shame.
Elisha mentioned the concept of foreboding joy, about always being on the lookout for the negative. Dr. Joan Borisenko can relate.
Well, let me tell you, I'm an expert on foreboding joy because I was brought up Jewish. And foreboding joy is big in that culture. So when I was little, let's say I was walking down the street with my mother and somebody says, oh, what a beautiful child. My mother would go, ah, can I hurry? Then she'd turn and spit over her left shoulder. I had no idea what this was, but it did make me like feel really weird. What is this? And then I finally realized when I got older that Kenahara is the Yiddish for the German keine Augen, no evil eye. That the idea in not just Jewish culture, but a lot of different cultures, is if you focus on something good, then you're alerting the evil eye that will come and take it away from you. And here's how I worked with this once in clinical practice. There was a woman who came to me, and she was in the throes of starting a new business. She was a very bright woman, a very competent woman, but there was an underlying issue of shame. It seemed she always fell short of her own potential. She had good ideas, but they wouldn't come into fruition. She had a habit of getting in her own way, of self-sabotage. And we were talking about, that she really wanted to portray herself in a very strong way to her clients, but that every time she would really want to do any kind of self-promotion, which, you know, you might not like it, but you got to do it these days. Any kind of self-promotion, she would get this idea like, oh, if I tell them how smart I am, I'm just going to fall in my face and it'll all be worse later. And so I told her the story of the Kenahara and gave her as a practice, whenever she felt this sense of foreboding joy, she should just say Kenahara and spit over her left shoulder. And it just broke it up for her. So she was really able to move forward, and it was such a simple and funny thing.
We looked at some ways to work with developmental shame in adults, but what happens when shame becomes so pervasive that it affects our physiology? We'll get to that in the next video. I'll see you there.